And that moment of silence was for the commuting of the sentence of Scooter Libby. What we have up next is a special edition of Standing Room Only. Be sure to tune in next week where we're going to have a live band on, and we'll probably have a few live bands after that. But this week, hey, we've got some important news for you. Scooter Libby, what the hell? 2.5 years, boo-hoo. But then it's commuted. Why? Why do these things happen? We'll try to get to the bottom of it. We're going to have some interviews, some news clips, clips from other forms of media, some music, and some other stuff. So sit back and enjoy the show. It's coming up next here on Standing Room Only, right here on killradio.org.
Question. What? This is a crime scene. What crime has been committed here?
Crime is that Scooter Libby was convicted in a fair trial. He is a felon. He is supposed to go to prison. And George Bush said he doesn't have to go to prison. He's one of us. He's a buddy. So we say that is not democracy. That's not the rule of law. That's not obeying the Constitution. You should go to jail.
Of Mr. Libby's.
Is the First Amendment void here in this spot?
No.
Can't free speech here?
We're protecting it right now.
I was wondering, what are the regulations here?
In between these two poles, you can't remain stationary because people are trying to take pictures and this and that. Outside those poles, you can remain stationary.
Pennsylvania Avenue?
So she's just going to walk around.
On Pennsylvania Avenue, too?
She's different. No, this is sidewalk.
Scooter Libby not going to prison after all. The Associated Press reporting President Bush has commuted Libby's 3-month sentence. Libby, of course, is Dick Cheney's, Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff. He was sentenced for lying and obstruction of justice during the CIA leak investigation. But again, we are just learning the Associated Press reporting President Bush has commuted Louis Scooter Libby's 30-month sentence. Continue to follow that one for you.
Mr. Libby's wife and children, and no doubt it was immense. But in our fourth story tonight, the president seems to have forgotten someone else's suffering, the victims and her families and their countries. Mr. Libby was not convicted of leaking the identity of covert CIA operative Valerie Plame, but he was convicted of obstructing the investigation into who had. She was his victim. Her torpedoed career was a victim, and so too were members of her family. She was targeted in the first place because her husband, former Ambassador Joe Wilson, dared expose disingenuous arguments for the war in Iraq. We spoke to Ambassador Wilson shortly after Mr. Bush's commutation announcement. Ambassador Wilson, thanks for joining us again tonight.
Good to be with you, Keith.
First, can you share the reaction you and your wife had upon hearing this news this evening?
Well, on the one hand, there's nothing that this administration does that surprises us anymore. It's corrupt from top to bottom, and I think most Americans should understand that beyond a reasonable doubt now. On the other hand, of course, as American citizens, we're outraged that the President of the United States would short-circuit the rule of law and the system of justice and really just repudiate everything that we stand for as Americans, including the decision by a jury of Mr. Libby's peers, confirmed by the judge in the case and reconfirmed by the Court of Appeals.
In many quarters, this is going to look like a quid pro quo, that Mr. Libby would have felt free to act as he did throughout this series of events, because perhaps all along he'd been promised some sort of get-out-of-jail-free card. Do you place any credence to that theory?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The president himself acknowledged in his statement today that Mr. Libby was guilty of serious crimes, and then he makes himself an accessory to the obstruction of justice by the mere act of commuting the sentence. So that now Mr. Libby, there is under no incentive whatsoever to tell the truth to the prosecutor, to remove that sand that Fitzgerald said that he threw into his eyes, or to do anything to lift the cloud that Mr. Fitzgerald says continues to exist over the office of the vice president.
In a typical case of sentence commuting, a commutation case, the felon is supposed to cooperate with the authorities. No indication that that has happened. Where do we now turn for answers about how this all happened? To Patrick Fitzgerald, to Congress, to your civil suit against Mr. Libby?
I would add to all three of those the necessity for the president now to come clean with the American people. He's been hiding behind this notion that he didn't want to get involved in an ongoing investigation until now. He has now short-circuited that investigation. He owes the American public some answers. I would hope that he would instruct the special counsel to release all the information he collected during the course of his investigation, beginning with the president's own interview with Mr. Fitzgerald and the vice president's interview with Mr. Fitzgerald. And if he fails to do that, and I have no expectation that he will, because he is corrupt to the core, I believe that the Congress should begin to investigate this matter.
Obviously, the onus of this is going has fallen today already on the president. He is the one who ultimately made the decision. He has described himself as the decider. But as some of your answers so far have suggested, the role of the vice president cannot be underestimated in this. Do you now, or when we're seemingly at conclusion, although I suppose Mr. Libby might still be pardoned at the end of the administration to wipe the record completely clean of what he has done, do you have in your mind a timeline of what happened and what the vice president's role was in all of this, including this commutation of sentence?
Well, certainly there are people who have been looking at the possible vice president's role more closely than I have. But I would insist, I think, that the vice president come clean on this, and certainly we expect to ask him some very pointed questions on this in the civil suit. And by the way, people can get information on the civil suit at www.wilsonsupport.org.
Ambassador, your wife's identity was considered fair game for this administration to sacrifice for political ends in hopes of ruining your reputation and, by doing so, ruining the impact of your criticism of the start of the war in Iraq. It has been reported that she was working on the issue of weapons of mass destruction, and without commenting on anything classified about what her work was specifically, what message does this gesture today send to other CIA operatives about their expendability, their fungibility within the Bush administration's scheme and vision of the world as it stands?
Well, let me say this. There's a lot of questions about the underlying crime, et cetera, and a lot of the sort of sect of neoconservatives and their acolytes in the American political system who have sort of argued that Mr. Libby didn't really commit a crime. But if a government official had spent the morning with the Russian military attaché for the express purpose of disclosing the identity of a covert CIA officer, what would Americans call that? We know in America the difference between right and wrong, even if this administration doesn't. And frankly, I think that for the CIA, its covert officers, and for the agents that are recruited by officers, those who would put their lives at risk in order to give us the intelligence we need, will think long and hard about it when they see that an administration with impunity will betray its covert officers, will engage in treason.
I would imagine, sir, in conclusion, that many watching this interview share your distress and your anger tonight. Do you have any guidance for your fellow citizens as to how to translate this feeling into some kind of productive action at this point?
Well, Congress is on leave all week. They will be out in the districts, and I think citizens should make sure they take advantage of every opportunity to meet with their congressmen to share with them that America is a country that is governed by rule of law, and we have a system of justice that has been usurped in what I think is an arbitrary and capricious act by a chief executive who is corrupt to the core and an administration that has demonstrated that it has absolutely no regard for those values that have made this the greatest country on earth for the last 220 years.
Joseph C. Wilson IV, our former acting ambassador to Iraq, in the wake of the commutation tonight of the sentence of Lewis Scooter Libby. Great. Thanks once again for some of your time tonight, sir.
Thanks very much, Keith. Good to be with you.
And earlier in this news...
The president handed out Purple Hearts to wounded soldiers at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, one day after commuting the prison sentence of Lewis Scooter Libby, who helped leak the identity of former CIA operative Valerie Wilson, whose husband publicly questioned the White House's case for the Iraq War.
I took this decision very seriously on Mr. Libby.
Mr. Bush left the door wide open to a full pardon.
As to the future, I'm, rule nothing in and nothing out.
The president said the jury verdict that Libby lied to the FBI should stand, along with the $250,000 fine and 2 years of probation.
But I felt like the 30-month sentencing was severe and made a judgment, a considered judgment, that I believe is the right decision to make in this case. And I stand by it.
Spokesman Tony Snow struggled to answer a barrage of questions, such as whether Vice President Cheney went to bat for his former chief of staff.
Vice President Wayne?
My guess is that I don't have direct knowledge, Ed, but on the other hand, the president did consult with most senior officials.
Why did the president ignore his own Justice Department's regular procedure?
Normally, somebody at least serves a day in jail, a week in jail.
I guess the president thought the jail time, in fact, was inappropriate, and therefore he decided to proceed.
He said it was excessive,
and he thought that any jail time was excessive.
Or why Karl Rove had not been fired, even though he played a role in the leak.
Do you stand by your pledge to fire anyone found to have done so?
Yes, and that's up to the U.S. Attorney to find the facts.
Tonight, as promised, a special comment on what is, in everything but name, George Bush's pardon of Scooter Libby. I didn't vote for him, an American once said, but he's my president and I hope he does a good job. That, on this eve of the 4th of July, is the essence of this democracy in 17 words. And that is what President Bush threw away yesterday in commuting the sentence of Lewis Scooter Libby. The man who said those 17 words, improbably enough, was the actor John Wayne. And John Wayne, an ultra-conservative, said them when he learned of the hair's breadth election of John F. Kennedy instead of his personal favorite, Richard Nixon, in 1960. I didn't vote for him, but he's my president, and I hope he does a good job. The sentiment was doubtlessly expressed earlier, but there's something especially appropriate about hearing it now in John Wayne's voice, the crisp, matter-of-fact acknowledgement that our form of government has survived, even though for nearly two centuries now, our commander-in-chief has also served simultaneously as the head of one political party and often the scourge of all others. We as citizens must at some point ignore a president's partisanship. Not that we may prosper as a nation, not that we may achieve, not that we may lead the world, but that merely we may function. But just as essential to the 17 words of John Wayne is an implicit trust, a sacred trust, that the president, for whom so many did not vote, can in turn suspend his political self long enough and for matters imperative enough to conduct himself solely for the benefit of the entire republic. Our generation's willingness to state we didn't vote for him, but he's our president and we hope he does a good job, was tested in the crucible of history and far earlier than most, and in circumstances far more tragic and threatening, and we did that with which history tasked us. We enveloped our president in 2001. And those who did not believe he should have been elected, indeed those who did not believe he had been elected, willingly lowered their voices and assented to the sacred oath of nonpartisanship. And George W. Bush took our assent and reconfigured it and honed it and sharpened it to razor-sharp points and stabbed this nation in the back with it. Were there any remaining lingering doubt otherwise, or any remaining lingering hope? It ended yesterday when Mr. Bush commuted the prison sentence of one of his own staffers. Did so even before the appeals process was complete. Did so without as much as a courtesy consultation with the Department of Justice. Did so despite what James Madison at the Constitutional Convention said about impeaching any president who pardoned or sheltered those who had committed crimes advised by that president. Did so without the slightest concern that even the most detached of citizens must look at this chain of events and wonder to what degree was Mr. Libby told, break the law however you wish, the president will keep you out of prison. In that moment, Mr. Bush, you broke that fundamental compact between yourself and the majority of this nation's citizens, the ones who did not cast votes for you. In that moment, Mr. Bush, you ceased to be the president of the United States. In that moment, Mr. Bush, you became merely the president of a rabid and irresponsible corner of the Republican Party. And this is too important a time, sir, to have a commander-in-chief who puts party ahead of nation. This has been, of course, the gathering legacy of this administration. Few of its decisions have escaped the stain of politics. The extraordinary Karl Rove has spoken of a permanent Republican majority. As if such a thing, or a permanent Democratic majority, is not antithetical to that upon which rests our country, our history, our revolution, our freedoms. Yet our democracy has survived shrewder men than Karl Rove, and it has survived the frequent stain of politics upon the fabric of government. But this administration, with ever-increasing insistence and almost theocratic zealotry, has turned that stain into a massive oil spill. The protection of the environment is turned over to those of one political party who will financially benefit from the rape of the environment. The protections of the Constitution are turned over to those of one political party who believe those protections unnecessary and extravagant and quaint. The enforcement of the laws is turned over to those of one political party who will swear beforehand that they will not enforce those laws. The choice between war and peace is turned over to those of one political party who stand to gain vast wealth by ensuring that there is never peace, but only war. And now, when just one cooked book gets corrected by an honest auditor, when just one trampling of the inherent and inviolable fairness of government is rejected by an impartial judge, when just one wild-eyed partisan is stopped by the figure of blind justice, this president decides that he, and not the law, must prevail. I accuse you, Mr. Bush, of lying this country into war. I accuse you of fabricating in the minds of your own people a false implied link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. I accuse you of firing the generals who told you that the plans for Iraq were disastrously insufficient. I accuse you of causing in Iraq the needless deaths of 3,586 of our brothers and sons and sisters and daughters and friends and neighbors. I accuse you of subverting the Constitution, not in some misguided but sincerely motivated struggle to combat terrorists, but instead to stifle dissent. I accuse you of fomenting fear among your own people, of creating the very terror you claim to have fought. I accuse you of exploiting that unreasoning fear, the natural fear of your own people who just want to live their lives in peace, as a political tool to slander your critics and libel your opponents. I accuse you of handing part of this republic over to a vice president who is without conscience and letting him run roughshod over it. And I accuse you now, Mr. Bush, of giving, through that vice president, carte blanche to Mr. Libby to help defame Ambassador Joseph Wilson by any means necessary to lie to grand juries and special counsel and before a court in order to protect the mechanisms and the particulars of that defamation with your guarantee that Libby would never see prison. And in so doing, as Ambassador Wilson himself phrased it here last night, of you becoming an accessory to the obstruction of justice. When President Nixon ordered the firing of Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox during the infamous Saturday Night Massacre on October 20th, 1973, Mr. Cox initially responded tersely and ominously. Whether ours shall be a government of laws and not of men, he said, is now for Congress and ultimately the American people. President Nixon did not understand how he had crystallized the issue of Watergate for the American people. It had been to that point about the obscure meaning behind an attempt to break into a rival party's headquarters and the labyrinthine effort to cover up that break-in and the related crimes. But in one night, Nixon transformed it. Watergate instantaneously became a simpler issue, a president overruling the inexorable march of the law, of insisting in a way that resonated viscerally with millions who had not previously understood that he was the law, not the Constitution, not the Congress, not the courts, just him. Just, Mr. Bush, as you did yesterday. The twists and turns of Plaingate, your precise and intricate lies that sent us into this bottomless pit of Iraq, your lies upon the lies to discredit Joe Wilson, your lies upon the lies upon the lies to throw the sand at the referee, of Prosecutor Fitzgerald's analogy, these are complex and often painful to follow, and too much, perhaps, for the average citizen. But when other citizens render a verdict against your man, Mr. Bush, and then you spit in the faces of those jurors and that judge and the judges who are yet to hear the appeal. The average citizen understands that, sir. It is the fixed ball game and the rigged casino and the prearranged lottery all rolled into one, and it stinks. And they know it. Nixon's mistake, the last and most fatal of them, the firing of Archibald Cox, was enough to cost him the presidency. And in the end, even Richard Nixon could say, he could not put this nation through an impeachment. It was far too late for it to matter then. But as the decades unfold, that single final gesture of nonpartisanship, of acknowledged responsibility not to self, not to party, not to base, but to country, echoes loudly into history. Even Richard Nixon knew it was time to resign. Would that you could say that, Mr. Bush, and that you could say it for Mr. Cheney. You both crossed the Rubicon yesterday. Which one of you chose the route no longer matters. Which is the ventriloquist and which is the dummy is now irrelevant. But that you have twisted the machinery of our government into nothing more than a tawdry machine of politics is the only fact that remains relevant. It is nearly July 4th, Mr. Bush, the commemoration of the moment we Americans decided that rather than live under a king who made up the laws or erased them or ignored them or commuted the sentences of those rightly convicted under them, we would force our independence and regain our sacred freedoms. We of this time and our leaders in Congress of both parties must now live up to those standards which echo through our history. Pressure, negotiate, impeach. Get you, Mr. Bush, and Mr. Cheney, two men who are now perilous to our democracy, away from its helm. And for you, Mr. Bush, and for Mr. Cheney, there is a lesser task. You need merely to achieve a very low threshold indeed. Display just that iota of patriotism which Richard Nixon showed on August 9, 1974. Resign and give us someone, anyone.
I have nothing but contempt and anger for those who betray the trust by exposing the name of our sources. They are, in my view, the most insidious of traitors.
Federal sentencing guidelines call for jail time in these kinds of cases of perjury and obstruction of justice. Why do you feel otherwise? And are you worried that this decision sends a signal that you won't go to jail if you lie to the FBI?
The hand was called by a court decision to go ahead and send Scooter Libby to jail while he was still in the middle of his appeals process.
How could it not be extraordinary to grant something to someone who didn't even ask for it?
This is a serious charge, by the way. We're talking about a criminal action. But it also hopefully will help set a clear signal if we expect other leaks to stop as well.
Contempt and anger. Those who betray the trust.
I took this decision very seriously on Mr. Libby.
About the historical parallel of this, it would be like if Richard Nixon on his way out or Gerald Ford on his way in had commuted the sentence of Bob Holliman, the former chief of staff, who was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice, or John Ehrlichman, same convictions, or former Attorney General John Mitchell. That's sort of the parallel, and that shows the seriousness of it, but Nixon nor Ford was about to touch that.
They have taken the attitude at the White House that somehow they're above the law. That if they make a decision that something they want to do, nobody should question them on it. The vice president's even been quoted as saying the courts can't question it, the Congress can't question it. That's a Nixonian attitude, and it's wrong. In America, no one is above the law. The president and the vice president are not above the law any more than you and I are.
Situation. He was found guilty, as we mentioned in the monologue. After the verdict was read, his wife said, "We're gonna fuck him." And I want to know who's him.
Yeah, really.
Is she talking about the jury? Is she talking about the people who threw Libby to the wall? Who's home? Now, I must say, Bill, I put this in my story, and we put the expletive in there, so you can't be sure it's Buck. She might have said appeal. But I don't know. I will go further and say, in fact, the word was Buck.
It felt good, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah. That's why you wanted to be on this show.
But it raises the question of who they want to fuck.
Maybe she met the people who convicted him.
Could have been the jury, could have been the judge, or could it be the vice president?
Yeah, I think she's talking about Rose and Bush and Cheney, who threw him to the wall.
If so, that's very frightening. The question is, you'd think that if he had some goods on him, he might have actually used that in his defense during the trial.
He did. That's what the defense's position was. He's the fall guy. That's what the jurors said when they came out of the box. You know what? We wished it was Rose and Cheney, but it wasn't. It was this guy who they threw to the wolves.
No, and I think there's a caution here, which is, I mean, obviously everyone's focused on Scooter Libby, but it's a big mistake if all of the attention gets focused on this one guy. It's actually good for the Republicans if it gets focused on Scooter Libby.
Why?
If it gets focused on Scooter Libby, then they have a fall guy.
Because
they can point on him. They can just sort of say, well, you know, he was a rogue guy. Who was the problem? Like, it was all about Scooter Libby.
Yeah, right.
All of this. And let's not. Scooter Libby is like saying I'm a gay-tweeted bodybuilder.
And let's. And we know you're not a bodybuilder.
But.
That's the point. Yes. And the actual crime, let's not forget, the actual crime was outing a spy. And I know the right
wing. Is that the actual crime?
Absolutely.
Because you know how we forget it all the time? Because every day there's a new layer of, like, you know, look that way, red herring, this on it, so we don't really know. The real thing maybe that some documents were forged that got us into a bullshit war?
Well, that's part of it, yes. That's what the spy's husband was looking into. Valerie playing with collateral damage to get back at this guy, Joe Wilson. And that's why they had some meeting and they said, okay, you guys, Rove and Libby, and you fan out and you talk to reporters and you tell them that you know whose wife was a wink-wink CIA agent. And, you know, I noticed that Bush feels bad about Scooter Libby. They all say he was a great guy and we're sorry. No apologies to Valerie Plame, who lost her career. No apologies to the other spies, you know, who worked at Dunder Mifflin, who got their cover blown.
Well, you know, this is the way they operate. I mean, last fall when my book came out, I got a call from a very senior reporter who said, you know, they're telling people, they've looked through your CIA records where I worked, you know, when I came out of college. And they said, well, there may be some inconsistencies there, right? And so they're going through my CIA records, right, over a book about compassion. You know, I mean, you can sort of think about...
You know, what this trial really brought out, I think, had very little to do with Scooter and probably was correct in saying that he was a fall guy. We learned that Ari Fleischer was leaking. We knew, as we already did, that Karl Rove was leaking. We know that Armitage over at the State Department, and everybody was leaking.
And that astronaut lady.
She probably was, too. Yes.
It's huge, though. I think it's way huger than we're even remembering, because it's about forged documents.
Well, partly,
that, you know, that got us into a war, and also it's about breaking down freedom of the press for people who like cannot protect their sources anymore.
Well, you know, I think
so
the press
actually.
So it's
like another bill. It's another one of our rights that's being diminished.
The press, except Dana, of course, deserves a fair amount of responsibility for this war.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, that's
the press did not do its duty.
No.
In pursuing intelligence on this war, there was a rush to judgment by the press on
right.
this war. So,
and let's not forget, Bush said, I know people have made a big deal about the fact that Clinton was impeached for the exact same charges that got Scooter Libby, lying, right, perjury, obstruction of justice. And Clinton said, I did not have sex with that woman. We know that was a lie. But Bush said, when this whole thing started to break, he said, if there's anyone in this administration who leaked classified information, I'd like to know who. Well, it was you. It's the guy you're shaving, right? Was it not George Bush who did that? Isn't he the guy who, now maybe Cheney came to him and said, we need this information, just sign it, you know, and Bush didn't really know what was going on. But it was him who was the guy that he was looking for. Not good grammar, but all right. I want to.
Everybody knows who it is. Everybody knows who's guilty, too. I think we all know, right?
Well, no, I don't think people follow this story. I think it's too convoluted. I think half the people who listen to this conversation say, what are they talking about? I heard something, but it's not about a blowjob, so I just get.
Hey everybody, Courtmeister 262, how are you? Me, I've been better. It bums me out a little bit that our president, our piece of shit who occupies the White House, has decided to commute the sentence of Scooter Libby. I mean, Bush, we already knew he was the executioner from Texas, but now I guess he's judge and jury because he violated the will of the jury in that case who convicted Scooter Libby of obstruction of justice. And for those of you who don't know, they outed a CIA agent who was working on finding weapons of mass destruction because her husband pissed them off. You know, not even the mafia will go after your wife if you make them mad or cross them. I mean, at least they have some ethics. Whereas the Bush crime family, you know, not so much. So he commutes Scooter Libby's sentence today so that he doesn't have to do any prison time because we all know how Scooter would squeal like a little bitch if he was in prison and he'd start talking, right? So, but he still has a record. He still has to do community service and all this, right? Uh-uh. You watch. When Bush leaves office, if Bush leaves office, he'll completely give Scooter a full pardon. I mean, you know, and so that he won't even have had a record. And this is after committing an act of treason. You know, it's never happened in U.S. history before. Never happened that somebody would reveal the name of a CIA operative who was active in the field doing vital work for political reasons. This has never happened before. I mean, they're willing to sacrifice CIA agents for their own political ends. What do you think that they would do with you or I? I mean, we're nothing to them. If they're willing to, you know, that's why there's an extra harsh penalty if you shoot a cop, because they figure, well, if you'll shoot a cop, well, who knows what you would do, right? It should be the same with outing a CIA officer. If they would do that, we have no idea what they would do. We need to call the White House, area code 202-456-1111 between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. and let them know how much this sucks. Flood them.
And we're going to make it very clear to everyone who works for the government that they can't go out and make a profit on their government work. They have to serve the people, and they better not even think about disclosing the identity of CIA covert agents if they expect to be around. I mean, you heard what the president did today, didn't you? Now, as I recall, the president said that if anybody in his White House were found to have had any part in disclosing the identity of Valerie Plame, they would be fired. Well, apparently that is another one of those statements by the president that just doesn't hold up, does it? And what we saw today was elevating cronyism over the rule of law. And what we saw today was further evidence that this administration has no regard whatsoever for what needs to be held sacred. And when I'm president, we're going to get back to cherishing the Constitution, upholding the rule of law, and putting forth the best values of America for the entire world to see again.
Because we've had an administration that doesn't believe in diplomacy. You know, they have every so often Condi Rice go around the world and show up somewhere and make a speech, and occasionally they even send Dick Cheney. That's hardly diplomatic in my view. So from what I would say,
great for the entire audience here tonight. superior answer about why you're a Democrat. Because, you know, people think that when you become successful, maybe you shouldn't be a Democrat.
If you're deciding what your political philosophy is, just imagine that you've gotten a chance to set the rules. You have to set the tax law, the wage and hour laws, the education system. You have the amount that you spent on medical care and all of these things. You have to set the whole rules, economic, political, social rules of society. At a problem. And you, it's you individually. It's 24 hours before you're born. And the genie says, well, there's just one catch. The 24 hours you emerge, just before you emerge. You're going to go over that big barrel over there. And it has 6 billion tickets in it, one for every person in the world. And you're going to pick out one ticket. That's your ticket for life. You'll get the cross on it. You'll get to change your ticket. That ticket may say male or female, 50-50. It may say smarter or retarded. It may say able-bodied or retarded. It may say rich or poor parents. It may say black or white. It may say Bangladesh or the United States. You're going to participate after having designed the world with all the schools. You're going to participate in what I call the Ovarian Lottery. It's the most important thing that happens in your life. Every one of you. That's it. Now, what kind of a world do you want to design not knowing what picture? I would submit, in terms of designing society that is neutral to the condition of welcome to time of war, I think that the Democrats do a better job.
Rockets, but their lives have been forever altered. Zainab, who's now 18, says her house was attacked last December. They took me to the hospital and I fainted. When I woke up, my legs were gone, she says. She waits for an appointment at Baghdad's Artificial Limb Center, one of two public facilities for amputees in the Iraqi capital. Zainab winces in pain as a doctor measures her strength and says she still has to wait at least a month before she can be fitted with prosthetic limbs. We follow Zainab to her house in eastern Baghdad's Obeidi neighborhood, where she said the attack that left her badly injured also killed her sister and sister-in-law. At first, she says she isn't scared, that she is strong, but then, I can't go out. I can't. What can I do? I remember that my family was all there, and in one moment, I was in the ambulance back to the house. After a month and a half, I came home, and my family was gone. According to Iraq's Ministry of Interior, one quarter of all injuries from the violence in Iraq involves the loss of at least one limb. The head of this center says it can make 1,200 artificial limbs a year, half the number needed to help amputees. For Zainab and thousands of Iraqis like her, getting new legs will only be the beginning of a lifelong recovery. Hala Gharani, CNN, Baghdad.
LeBron's to Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut on ABC yesterday. I hope these terrorist attacks in London wake us up here in America to stop the petty partisan fighting, he said. A partisan gridlock over the question of whether the American government can listen into conversations or follow email trails of non-American citizens. Actually, Senator, if you'd been paying attention, the NSA spying program included surveillance of American citizens. And you're right, it is petty partisan fighting between people who support the United States Constitution and people like you. The silver tonight to Sean Hannity of Fox Noise, reminding us that the 4th annual Hannity Freedom Concert is coming up in September, an evening of patriotism and inspiration featuring Hannity, Leanne Rimes, Lee Greenwood, and Oliver North. A flag-waving all-American, don't tread on me, love it or leave it, God bless the USA occasion, which is sponsored by the Hong Kong Tourism Board. But our winner, by unanimous decision, the 43rd President of the United States, who has tonight commuted the sentence of one of the key members of his own administration, who has done it gutlessly by press release, who has buried it on the Monday of the longest 4th of July weekend possible, and who has, in so doing, forfeited his claim to being president of anything larger than a small, privileged, elitist, undemocratic, anti-constitutional cabal. As Oliver Cromwell said to the infamous Rump Parliament in England more than 350 years ago, "You have sat too long for any good you have been doing lately. Depart, I say, and let us have done with you. In the name of God, go." George Walker Bush, today's worst person in the world. As you may have suspected, tomorrow night here on Countdown, a special comment calling on this vice president and this president to resign. Tomorrow night on Countdown.
When you and I spoke about a year and a half ago, you expressed some surprise that Cheney wasn't an unindicted co-conspirator in all this. Does that mean then that you believe that this is somehow some sort of cover-up here?
Well, I think that today's action is going to support the idea that Scooter Libby was a designated defendant and that he was a surrogate for the vice president. I mean, if you went through the trial, it was all about the vice president. You know, Scooter Libby didn't spontaneously decide to do all this. He was sent to a task by Dick Cheney. It was Dick Cheney that was involved in the allegations and whether there was uranium and or whatever being sought after in Africa. Dick Cheney ran through this. He was actually the spine of the entire trial, but he wasn't a defendant or an unindicted co-conspirator. And so there was this view among many that Scooter Libby was expected to carry this water for the vice president. What was also very surprising is that Scooter Libby got this incredibly aggressive team that's known for its aggressive tactics in trial. And they, in fact, had a signature plan that they announced. They're going to call Dick Cheney. They're going to really horn into the White House. And then suddenly it evaporated. All the promises, their indications were gone. And they actually had a very sort of staid defense, and they stayed well away from people like Dick Cheney. And many of us thought that that seemed to be an effort to preserve the option for a pardon. He was a loyal soldier all the way through this. With this entire sort of capital drama, you know, it's going to strike many correctly as the part of political kabuki. You know, this guy plays this role, saved at the final hour, days from his demise, by a grateful king. And the problem is that all along, President Bush says, we got to let the legal system work. We got to let the jury make a decision. We got to let the judges do this. We got to let this prosecutor do this. But it's going to look like he was only giving them that opportunity so long as they came to the conclusion he wanted. And the very day that they did not, the very day that even Republicans said this man needs to go to jail, he then says, well, you know what, I don't agree, so I'm going to change this. And I think that does really undermine the system. It has really very little to do with whether there was an intent to disclose a covert operative's name. He was convicted of lying. And every time his investigators got close to Dick Cheney, the lights seemed to go off in the investigation. So I was not impressed at all with the investigation. But none of that really saves Scooter Libby. I mean, the problem is he was convicted of crimes. And this president has been one of the most miserly presidents in history when it comes to pardons. And he is the last guy that I know of that complains about the harshness of sentences. His administration has defended sentences that have been condemned internationally because they're too harsh. Scooter Libby gets, a multiple month sentence, and he says, this is too severe for me to tolerate.
Elvis is dead. All the evidence points to the presence of weapons of mass destruction. I know what you did last summer. I did not have sexual relations with that woman. No, that dress doesn't make your bum look big. OJ is innocent. Of course Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. I am not a crook, said Richard Nixon. When asked who cut down his father's cherry tree, the young George Washington replied, I cannot tell a lie, Papa. I cut it with my little hatchet. When George Bush commuted Scooter Libby's sentence, he basically said, lying's okay. Factually speaking, the whole thing with the cherry tree was probably the invention of George Washington's first biographer. But who needs facts when you're no longer living in a reality-based paradigm? The fact is, we'll never know how Scooter Libby would have got on with a cellmate with a name like Freight Train Larry. The fact is, Scooter Libby was in Dick Cheney's carpool, and he's not going to jail. Whether or not he actually cut down a cherry tree, George Washington will be remembered as someone who simply couldn't tell a lie. As to how George Bush will be remembered, only time will tell. Nonetheless, happy 4th of July, people. This video is supplied for patriotic purposes only. After all, who doesn't love a parade? Or kittens? This video was planned at fairly short notice. There'll be more later in the week. See you next time. Cheers.
Of Mr. Libby's.
Is the First Amendment void here in this spot?
No, no, no.
Can you have free speech here?
We're protecting it right now.
I was wondering, what are the regulations here?
Just in between these two poles, you can't remain stationary because people are trying to take pictures and this and that. Outside those poles, you can remain stationary.
Pennsylvania Avenue?
So she's just going to walk around.
On Pennsylvania Avenue, too?
She's different. No, this is sidewalk.
This news just coming into us here at Prime News. Apparently, Louis Scooter Libby not going to prison after all. The Associated Press reporting President Bush has commuted Libby's 3-month sentence. Libby, of course, is Dick Cheney's, Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff. He was sentenced for lying and obstruction of justice during the CIA leak investigation. But again, we are just learning, the Associated Press reporting President Bush has commuted Louis Scooter Libby's 30-month sentence. Continue to follow that one for you.
Mr. Libby's wife and children, and no doubt it was immense. In our fourth story tonight, the president seems to have forgotten someone else's suffering, the victims and her families and their countries. Mr. Libby was not convicted of leaking the identity of covert CIA operative Valerie Plame, but he was convicted of obstructing the investigation into who had. She was his victim. Her torpedoed career was a victim, and so too were members of her family. She was targeted in the first place because her husband, former Ambassador Joe Wilson, dared expose disingenuous arguments for the war in Iraq. We spoke to Ambassador Wilson shortly after Mr. Bush's commutation announcement. Ambassador Wilson, thanks for joining us again tonight.
Good to be with you, Keith.
First, can you share the reaction you and your wife had upon hearing this news this evening?
Well, on the one hand, there's nothing that this administration does that surprises us anymore. It's corrupt from top to bottom, and I think most Americans should understand that beyond a reasonable doubt now. On the other hand, of course, as American citizens, we're outraged that the President of the United States would short-circuit the rule of law and the system of justice and really just repudiate everything that we stand for as Americans, including the decision by a jury of Mr. Libby's peers, confirmed by the judge in the case and reconfirmed by the Court of Appeals.
In many quarters, this is going to look like a quid pro quo, that Mr. Libby would have felt free to act as he did throughout this series of events because perhaps all along he'd been promised some sort of get-out-of-jail-free card. Do you place any credence to that theory?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The president himself acknowledged in his statement today that Mr. Libby was guilty of serious crimes, and then he makes himself an accessory to the obstruction of justice by the mere act of commuting the sentence. So that now Mr. Libby, there is under no incentive whatsoever to tell the truth to the prosecutor, to remove that sand that Fitzgerald said that he threw into his eyes, or to do anything to lift the cloud that Mr. Fitzgerald says continues to exist over the office of the vice president.
In a typical case of sentence commuting, a commutation case, the felon is supposed to cooperate with the authorities. No indication that that has happened. Where do we now turn for answers about how this all happened? To Patrick Fitzgerald, to Congress, to your civil suit against Mr. Libby?
I would add to all three of those the necessity for the president now to come clean with the American people. He's been hiding behind this notion that he didn't want to get involved in an ongoing investigation until now. He has now short-circuited that investigation. He owes the American public some answers. I would hope that he would instruct the special counsel to release all the information he collected during the course of his investigation, beginning with the president's own interview with Mr. Fitzgerald and the vice president's interview with Mr. Fitzgerald. And if he fails to do that, and I have no expectation that he will, because he is corrupt to the core, I believe that the Congress should begin to investigate this matter.
Obviously, the onus of this is going to fall, has fallen today already on the president. He is the one who ultimately made the decision. He has described himself as the decider. But as some of your answers so far have suggested, the role of the vice president cannot be underestimated in this. Do you now, or when we're seemingly at conclusion, although I suppose Mr. Libby might still be pardoned at the end of the administration to wipe the record completely clean of what he has done, do you have in your mind a timeline of what happened and what the vice president's role was in all of this, including this commutation of sentence?
Well, certainly there are people who have been looking at the possible vice president's role more closely than I have. But I would insist, I think, that the vice president come clean on this, and certainly we expect to ask him some very pointed questions on this in the civil suit. And by the way, people can get information on the civil suit at www.wilsonsupport.org.
Ambassador, your wife's identity was considered fair game for this administration to sacrifice for political ends in hopes of ruining your reputation and by doing so ruining the impact of your criticism of the start of the war in Iraq. It has been reported that she was working on the issue of weapons of mass destruction, and without commenting on anything classified about what her work was specifically, what message does this gesture today send to other CIA operatives about their expendability, their fungibility within the Bush administration's scheme and vision of the world as it stands?
Well, let me say this. There's a lot of questions about the underlying crime, et cetera, and a lot of the sort of sect of neoconservatives and their acolytes in the American political system who have sort of argued that Mr. Libby didn't really commit a crime. But if a government official had spent the morning with the Russian military attaché for the express purpose of disclosing the identity of a covert CIA officer, what would Americans call that? We know in America the difference between right and wrong, even if this administration doesn't. And frankly, I think that for the CIA, its covert officers, and for the agents that are recruited by officers, those who would put their lives at risk in order to give us the intelligence we need, will think long and hard about it when they see that an administration with impunity will betray its covert officers, will engage in treason.
I would imagine, sir, in conclusion, that many watching this interview share your distress and your anger tonight. Do you have any guidance for your fellow citizens as to how to translate this feeling into some kind of productive action at this point?
Well, Congress is on leave all week. They will be out in the districts, and I think citizens should make sure they take advantage of every opportunity to meet with their congressmen to share with them that America is a country that is governed by rule of law, and we have a system of justice that has been usurped in what I think is an arbitrary and capricious act by a chief executive who is corrupt to the core, and an administration that has demonstrated that it has absolutely no regard for those values that have made this the greatest country on earth for the last 220 years.
Joseph C. Wilson IV, our former acting ambassador to Iraq, in the wake of the commutation tonight of the sentence of Lewis Scooter Libby. Great. Thanks once again for some of your time tonight, sir.
Thanks very much, Keith. Good to be with you.
And earlier in this news...
The president handed out Purple Hearts to wounded soldiers at Walter Reed Army Medical Center one day after commuting the prison sentence of Lewis Scooter Libby, who helped leak the identity of former CIA operative Valerie Wilson, whose husband publicly questioned the White House's case for the Iraq War.
I took this decision very seriously on Mr. Libby.
Mr. Bush left the door wide open to a full pardon.
As to the future, I'm, rule nothing in and nothing out.
The president said the jury verdict that Libby lied to the FBI should stand, along with the $250,000 fine and 2 years of probation.
But I felt like the 30-month sentencing was severe. I made a judgment, a considered judgment, that I believe is the right decision to make in this case. And I stand by it.
Spokesman Tony Snow struggled to answer a barrage of questions, such as whether Vice President Cheney went to bat for his former chief of staff.
Vice President, weigh in.
My guess is that I don't have direct knowledge, Ed, but on the other hand, the president did consult with most senior officials.
Why did the president ignore his own Justice Department's regular procedure?
Normally, somebody at least serves a day in jail, a week in jail.
Because the president thought the jail time, in fact, was inappropriate, and therefore he decided to proceed.
The jail time was excessive. The sentence
right.
was excessive.
Yeah, it was excessive.
It was inappropriate.
He said it was excessive, and he thought that any jail time was excessive.
Or why Karl Rove has not been fired, even though he played a role in the leak.
Do you stand by your pledge to fire anyone found to have done so?
Yes, and that's up to the U.S. attorney to find the facts.
Finally tonight, as promised, a special comment on what is, in everything but name, George Bush's pardon of Scooter Libby. I didn't vote for him, an American once said, but he's my president and I hope he does a good job. That, on this eve of the 4th of July, is the essence of this democracy in 17 words. And that is what President Bush threw away yesterday in commuting the sentence of Lewis Scooter Libby. The man who said those 17 words, improbably enough, was the actor John Wayne. And John Wayne, an ultra-conservative, said them when he learned of the hair's breadth election of John F. Kennedy instead of his personal favorite, Richard Nixon, in 1960. I didn't vote for him, but he's my president, and I hope he does a good job. The sentiment was doubtlessly expressed earlier, but there's something especially appropriate about hearing it now in John Wayne's voice, the crisp, matter-of-fact acknowledgement that our form of government has survived, even though for nearly two centuries now, our commander-in-chief has also served simultaneously as the head of one political party and often the scourge of all others. We as citizens must at some point ignore a president's partisanship. Not that we may prosper as a nation, not that we may achieve, not that we may lead the world, but that merely we may function. But just as essential to the 17 words of John Wayne is an implicit trust, a sacred trust, that the president, for whom so many did not vote, can in turn suspend his political self long enough and for matters imperative enough to conduct himself solely for the benefit of the entire republic. Our generation's willingness to state we didn't vote for him, but he's our president if we hope he does a good job, was tested in the crucible of history and far earlier than most. And in circumstances far more tragic and threatening. And we did that with which history tasked us. We enveloped our president in 2001. And those who did not believe he should have been elected, indeed those who did not believe he had been elected, willingly lowered their voices and assented to the sacred oath of nonpartisanship. And George W. Bush took our assent and reconfigured it and honed it and sharpened it to razor-sharp points and stabbed this nation in the back with it. Were there any remaining lingering doubt otherwise, or any remaining lingering hope? It ended yesterday when Mr. Bush commuted the prison sentence of one of his own staffers, did so even before the appeals process was complete, did so without as much as a courtesy consultation with the Department of Justice, did so despite what James Madison at the Constitutional Convention said about impeaching any president who pardoned or sheltered those who had committed crimes advised by that president. Did so without the slightest concern that even the most detached of citizens must look at this chain of events and wonder to what degree was Mr. Libby told, break the law however you wish, the president will keep you out of prison. In that moment, Mr. Bush, you broke that fundamental compact between yourself and the majority of this nation's citizens, the ones who did not cast votes for you. In that moment, Mr. Bush, you ceased to be the president of the United States. In that moment, Mr. Bush, you became merely the president of a rabid and irresponsible corner of the Republican Party. And this is too important a time, sir, to have a commander-in-chief who puts party ahead of nation. This has been, of course, the gathering legacy of this administration. Few of its decisions have escaped the stain of politics. The extraordinary Karl Rove has spoken of a permanent Republican majority. As if such a thing, or a permanent Democratic majority, is not antithetical to that upon which rests our country, our history, our revolution, our freedoms. Yet our democracy has survived shrewder men than Karl Rove, and it has survived the frequent stain of politics upon the fabric of government. But this administration, with ever-increasing insistence and almost theocratic zealotry, has turned that stain into a massive oil spill. The protection of the environment is turned over to those of one political party who will financially benefit from the rape of the environment. The protections of the Constitution are turned over to those of one political party who believe those protections unnecessary and extravagant and quaint. The enforcement of the laws is turned over to those of one political party who will swear beforehand that they will not enforce those laws. The choice between war and peace is turned over to those of one political party who stand to gain vast wealth by ensuring that there is never peace but only war. And now, when just one cooked book gets corrected by an honest auditor, when just one trampling of the inherent and inviolable fairness of government is rejected by an impartial judge, when just one wild-eyed partisan is stopped by the figure of blind justice, this president decides that he, and not the law, must prevail. I accuse you, Mr. Bush, of lying this country into war. I accuse you of fabricating in the minds of your own people a false implied link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. I accuse you of firing the generals who told you that the plans for Iraq were disastrously insufficient. I accuse you of causing in Iraq the needless deaths of 3,586 of our brothers and sons and sisters and daughters and friends and neighbors. I accuse you of subverting the Constitution, not in some misguided but sincerely motivated struggle to combat terrorists, but instead to stifle dissent. I accuse you of fomenting fear among your own people, of creating the very terror you claim to have fought. I accuse you of exploiting that unreasoning fear, the natural fear of your own people who just want to live their lives in peace, as a political tool to slander your critics and libel your opponents. I accuse you of handing part of this republic over to a vice president who is without conscience and letting him run roughshod over it. And I accuse you now, Mr. Bush, of giving, through that vice president, carte blanche to Mr. Libby to help defame Ambassador Joseph Wilson by any means necessary, to lie to grand juries and special counsel and before a court in order to protect the mechanisms and the particulars of that defamation, with your guarantee that Libby would never see prison. And in so doing, as Ambassador Wilson himself phrased it here last night, of you becoming an accessory to the obstruction of justice. When President Nixon ordered the firing of Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox during the infamous Saturday Night Massacre on October 20th, 1973, Mr. Cox initially responded tersely and ominously. "Whether ours shall be a government of laws and not of men," he said, "is now for Congress and ultimately the American people." President Nixon did not understand how he had crystallized the issue of Watergate for the American people. It had been to that point about the obscure meaning behind an attempt to break into a rival party's headquarters and the labyrinthine effort to cover up that break-in and the related crimes. But in one night, Nixon transformed it. Watergate instantaneously became a simpler issue, a president overruling the inexorable march of the law, of insisting in a way that resonated viscerally with millions who had not previously understood that he was the law, not the Constitution, not the Congress, not the courts, just him. Just, Mr. Bush, as you did yesterday. The twists and turns of Plaingate, your precise and intricate lies that sent us into this bottomless pit of Iraq, your lies upon the lies to discredit Joe Wilson, your lies upon the lies upon the lies to throw the sand at the referee of Prosecutor Fitzgerald's analogy. These are complex and often painful to follow, and too much, perhaps, for the average citizen. But when other citizens render a verdict against your man, Mr. Bush, and then you spit in the faces of those jurors and that judge and the judges who are yet to hear the appeal. The average citizen understands that, sir. It is the fixed ball game and the rigged casino and the prearranged lottery all rolled into one, and it stinks. And they know it. Nixon's mistake, the last and most fatal of them, the firing of Archibald Cox, was enough to cost him the presidency. And in the end, even Richard Nixon could say, he could not put this nation through an impeachment. It was far too late for it to matter then. But as the decades unfold, that single final gesture of nonpartisanship, of acknowledged responsibility not to self, not to party, not to base, but to country, echoes loudly into history. Even Richard Nixon knew it was time to resign. Would that you could say that, Mr. Bush, and that you could say it for Mr. Cheney. You both crossed the Rubicon yesterday. Which one of you chose the route no longer matters. Which is the ventriloquist and which is the dummy is now irrelevant. But that you have twisted the machinery of our government into nothing more than a tawdry machine of politics is the only fact that remains relevant. It is nearly July 4th, Mr. Bush, the commemoration of the moment we Americans decided that rather than live under a king who made up the laws, or erased them, or ignored them, or commuted the sentences of those rightly convicted under them, we would force our independence and regain our sacred freedoms. We of this time, and our leaders in Congress of both parties, must now live up to those standards which echo through our history. Pressure, negotiate, impeach. Get you, Mr. Bush, and Mr. Cheney, two men who are now perilous to our democracy, away from its helm. And for you, Mr. Bush, and for Mr. Cheney, there is a lesser task. You need merely to achieve a very low threshold indeed. Display just that iota of patriotism which Richard Nixon showed on August 9, 1974. Resign and give us someone, anyone.
The trust by exposing the name of our sources. They are, in my view, the most insidious traitors.
Federal sentencing guidelines call for jail time in these kinds of cases of perjury and obstruction of justice. Why do you feel otherwise? And are you worried that this decision sends a signal that you won't go to jail if you lie to the FBI?
The hand was called by a court decision to go ahead and send Scooter Libby to jail while he was still in the middle of his appeals process.
How can it not be extraordinary to grant something to someone who didn't even ask for it?
This is a serious charge, by the way. We're talking about a criminal action. But it also hopefully will help set a clear signal. We expect other leaks to stop as well.
Contempt and anger. Those who betray the trust.
I took this decision very seriously on Mr. Libby.
About the historical parallel of this, it would be like if Richard Nixon on his way out or Gerald Ford on his way in had commuted the sentence of Bob Haldeman, the former chief of staff, who was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice, or John Ehrlichman, same convictions, or former Attorney General John Mitchell. That's sort of the parallel, and that shows the seriousness of it, but Nixon nor Ford was about to touch that.
They have taken the attitude at the White House that somehow they're above the law. That if they make a decision that something they want to do, nobody should question them on it. The vice president's even been quoted as saying the courts can't question it, the Congress can't question it. That's a Nixonian attitude, and it's wrong. In America, no one is above the law. The president and the vice president are not above the law any more than you and I are.
Ask you about this Scooter Libby situation. He was found guilty, as we mentioned in the monologue. After the verdict was read, his wife said, "We're gonna fuck him." And I want to know who's him.
Yeah, really.
Is she talking about the jury? Is she talking about the people who threw Libby to the wolves? Who's own?
Now, I must say, Bill, I put this in my story, and we put the expletive in there, so you can't be sure it's fuck. She might have said appeal. I will go further and say, in fact, the word was fuck.
I felt good, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah. That's why you wanted to be on this show.
But it raises the question. Maybe it raises the question of who they want to fuck.
Maybe she met the people who convicted them.
Could have been the jury, could have been the judge. Oh, could it be the vice president?
Yes, I think she's talking about Rove and Bush and Cheney, who threw him to the wolves.
And if so, that's very frightening. The question is, you'd think that if he had some goods on them, he might have actually used that in his defense during the trial.
He did. That's what the defense's position was. He's the fall guy. That's what the jurors said when they came out of the box. You know what? We wished it was Rove and Cheney, but it wasn't. It was this guy who they threw to the wolves.
No, and I think there's a caution here, which is, I mean, obviously everyone's focused on Scooter Libby, but it's a big mistake if all of the attention gets focused on this one guy. It's actually good for the Republicans if it gets focused on Scooter Libby.
Why?
If it gets focused on Scooter Libby, then they have a fall guy.
Because
they can point on him. They can just sort of say, well, you know, he was a rogue guy. He was the problem. Right. It was all about Scooter Libby.
Yeah, right.
All of this about Scooter Libby is like saying I'm a gay Swedish bodybuilder.
And let's... and we know you're not a bodybuilder. But,
that's the point.
Yes. And the actual crime, let's not forget, the actual crime was outing a spy. And I know the right wing...
Is that the actual crime?
Absolutely.
Because you know how we forget it all the time? Because every day there's a new layer of, like, you know, look that way, red herring, dishonest, so we don't really know. Was the real thing maybe that some documents were forged that got us into a bullshit war?
Well, that's part of it, yes. That's what the spy's husband was looking into. Valerie Plame was collateral damage to get back at this guy, Joe Wilson. And that's why they had some meeting and they said, okay, you guys... Rove and Libby, and you fan out, and you talk to reporters, and you tell them that you know whose wife was a wink wink CIA agent,
And, you know, I noticed that Bush feels bad about Scooter Libby. They all say he was a great guy and we're sorry. No apologies to Valerie Plame, who lost her career. No apologies to the other spies, you know, who worked at Dunder Mifflin, who got their cover blown.
Well, you know, this is the way they operate. I mean, last fall when my book came out, I got a call from a very senior reporter who said, you know, they're telling people, they've looked through your CIA records where I worked, you know, when I came out of college. And they said, well, there may be some inconsistencies there, right? And so they're going through my CIA records, right, over a book about compassion. You know, I mean, you can sort of think about...
You know, what this trial really brought out, I think, had very little to do with Scooter and probably was correct in saying that he was a fall guy. We learned that Ari Fleischer was leaking. We knew, as we already did, that Karl Rove was leaking. We know that Armitage over at the State Department, everybody was leaking.
And that astronaut lady.
She probably was, too. Yes.
It's huge, though. I think it's way huger than we're even remembering because it's about forged documents.
Well,
that
partly,
said,
yeah.
That, you know, that got us into a war. And also it's about breaking down freedom of the press for people who, like, cannot protect their sources anymore.
Well, you know, I think the press
actually... It's another one of our rights that's being diminished.
The press, except Dana, of course, deserves a fair amount of responsibility for this war.
Yes.
I mean, that's true.
The press did not do its duty, right, in pursuing intelligence on this war. There was a rush to judgment by the press on
right.
this war. So,
and let's not forget, Bush said, I know, now, people have made a big deal about the fact that Clinton was impeached for the exact same charges that got Scooter Libby. Lying, right? Perjury, obstruction of justice. And Clinton said, I did not have sex with that woman. We know that was a lie. But Bush said, when this whole thing started to break, he said, if there's anyone in this administration who leaked classified information, I'd like to know who. Well, it was you. It's the guy you're shaving, right? Was it not George Bush who did that? Isn't he the guy? Now, maybe Cheney came to him and said, we need this information, just sign it, you know. And Bush didn't really know what was going on. But it was him who was the guy that he was looking for. Not good grammar, but all right. I want to...
Everybody knows who it is. Everybody knows who's guilty, too. I think we all know, right?
Well, no, I don't think people follow this story. I think it's too convoluted. I think half the people who listen to this conversation say, what are they talking about? I heard something, but it's not about a blowjob, so I just get...